Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show, everybody. I better fix that thing. It's all screwy. Cockeyed. Hey, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Welcome to it. It's the Scott Horton Show. No Agenda Radio. ScottHorton.org. Got 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003 at ScottHorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. You know, for those of you who like the Facebook. All right, good one today. I'm guessing. I'm predicting. It'll be a good one today. Kelly Vlahos will be here. From the American Conservative Magazine and Antiwar.com. And she's got, one good one at each. And in fact, the one is running at the other anyway. Huh? Yeah, at Antiwar.com right now, they have a link to a Kelly Vlahos piece in the American Conservative, is what I'm trying to tell you. And also, she's got a brand new blog entry that's worth talking about, too. So there you go, a twofer. With Kelly Vlahos coming up on the show. And then, the show's new sponsor will be joining us for an interview. And I'm really excited about this because I like promoting these guys anyway. Not that I have been doing a good enough job of it or anything. But I really like Michael Bolden and his group and their strategy, their activity, their project. At the 10th Amendment Center. Because after all, Lysander Spooner can be right about the Constitution. But compared to what we've got now, the Constitution, what the Constitution describes about 90% of the way toward a free society from here. So, I'm not saying I would settle for it. I'd settle for it. But at least, it's progress. It would be progress if we could get the 10th Amendment, get some teeth in that thing. And Michael Bolden, he keeps, putting teeth in it. Got this genius friend who said to me, it's true what you say that there's no such thing as the law. It is just a concept. But what makes it true is people acting like it. What makes it true is a judge letting a guy off because, hey, exclusionary rule, man, tough. Sorry, prosecutors. Or locking a rich guy in a slammer for his ripoff. Maybe you can afford a good lawyer, but you're still guilty as hell, and off you go. And when people act like there's really a law, then, hey, there kinda is. Well, I guess that goes for the 10th Amendment, too. Where states stand up for their reserved powers against the national government, why, behold, there lies the 10th Amendment. It's not self-enforcing. It's Bolden enforcing. So anyway, I'm very happy to announce that the 10th Amendment Center is now sponsoring this show, which means that you'll get to hear pro-10th Amendment Center propaganda on the show every day, and along with every interview that you download, and you'll be able to see their awesome logos on my website at scotthorton.org, and you'll learn all about it. And, at least from time to time, you'll hear Michael Bolden and others from his organization on the show promoting their business. You gotta admit, it's pretty alright, Oh, no, another infomercial. Oh, well, it's just an interview he would have done anyway, right? You don't complain when I interview Phil Giraldi or Sheldon Richmond from the Council for the National Interest and the Future Freedom Foundation. Right, because why would you? I'd be interviewing them anyway. Well, same thing here. And in fact, for those of you who are politically correct left-wing types, I would have you know that the 10th Amendment Center is at least pretty much, more or less, Mother Jones Magazine approved. And these are people who would love to paint the 10th Amendment Center as some neo-Confederate, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. right-wing secessionist group of meanies or something. But they met Michael Bolton and they interviewed him and they just couldn't get over the fact that, that smear's just not going to stick here. He's a good guy, Michael Bolton, according to even Mother Jones. So anyway, good times. That's the show for today. I'm actually still waiting to hear back from one more guest that I've got to invite out to. And we still got time before it would be time for him to be on the show, so that's all right. Maybe that'll work out. Tomorrow, I'm going to be interviewing David Vine. I know I don't have a show on Saturday, but what I do have is a show on Sunday. They moved my KPFK show from Friday night drive time to Sunday morning hangover slot. That's all right. They're going to move me to Monday afternoons, I think, next month. I better make sure to call dibs on that. But anyway, so I'm on Sunday mornings now on KPFK. And you know what? I'm not really complaining. I'm sort of just kidding around because the fact is that the same guy that moved me from Friday night to Saturday morning is the same guy who's now really pushing to get my show syndicated on the other Pacifica stations around the country, too. So that's pretty damn good, ain't it? All right. I ain't complaining. Point being, tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to record an interview with David Vine, author of Island of Shame and author of a great many wonderful Tom Dispatch pieces, including a new one about the buildup of the American Empire's basing structure in Italy. You know, so that we can better, so the U.S. government can better target and attack and kill people in Africa. Ah, yes, creeping AFRICOM, the dark continent. You know why they call it the dark continent? Because all of what the American government does there is secret. Get it? Well, it's not that secret. Anyway, we're going to talk all about that with David Vine on the show tomorrow. And you know what? I guess if you wanted, you could say there's a contest. If I wanted, I could say there's a contest. It's unofficial. I'm just making it up right now, actually. But it's a contest between Nick Terse and David Vine, writer for Tom Dispatch and editor of Tom Dispatch, for who's best at describing America's empire of bases. Now, I believe that I would have to say that Nick Terse has the edge online, but that David Vine has a better treatment of it in book form than Nick Terse has written thus far. However, that may not be true because now that I think of it, Nick Terse has written books I haven't read. But anyway, these two guys both are absolutely great on America's empire bases. And in the book Island of Shame about Diego Garcia, David Vine has a whole section where he just examines the empire bases all around the world. And Nick Terse, too. They're both just great. And they count both at least approximately 1,000 now, give or take Iraq and Afghanistan bases. But approximately 1,000 military bases in other people's countries. There's another 1,000 here in America. Or however many, I don't know. I forgot. I actually asked Terse at one point, but I don't remember what he said anymore. But anyway, long story short, the wonderful journalist David Vine will be on this phone line tomorrow because I'm going to interview him about AFRICOM and his new article about AFRICOM that's running at Tom Dispatch. Which, in fact, I think it's running at antiwar.com today as well. And then that's going to play in Los Angeles on Sunday morning. You know, so on their way to church, people can listen to the U.S. government about the U.S. government killing people. And then they can go in there and pray for him. It'll be great. You know, I heard the funniest thing on the way to church this morning. They said the United States is invading Africa. Yeah, they're going to kill them all and take all their stuff and try to keep the Chinese out. Huh. Who knew? That's what I'm going for. We'll see what happens. All right. So that's the show for today. Kelly Vallejos, Michael Bolden, and maybe one other guest that I'm not telling you because it's still a maybe. And then Sunday morning on Anti-War Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. We should be talking with David Vine. I guess could fall through, but yeah, David Vine, Sunday morning, KPFK. Okay. All right. So now, I'm going to save that for the Kelly Vallejos interview. Let me talk to you real quick about this interview I saw on Colbert last night, where he interviewed David Finkel. Now, you all remember David Finkel, right? Longtime listeners of this show certainly are familiar. He's the Washington Post reporter who wrote the book The Good Soldiers, where he was embedded with a group of U.S. Army in East Baghdad in 2007. Their surge against the Sadrists, the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr and the rebels of Sadr City. And he's the guy who you can read about in Manning's chat logs with Lamo, the rat, that he was frustrated by the fact that this guy, Finkel, had the video. He clearly had the video, or at least he was able to sit and watch the video, because he wrote about it in his book, The Good Soldiers, and yet he never released the video to the people, to the readers of the Washington Post. And this was the collateral murder video, the Apache helicopter massacring the reporters and then the rescuers who tried to come and provide first aid. Ended up shooting the rescuers' two children, who miraculously survived, but with horrible injuries. And anyway, this was the group that he was embedded with, Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich's group. And, in fact, I had already interviewed Josh Stieber on the show before this video was released. I think, yeah, about the book. And only later did the video come out, and there he is, one of the first guys responding on the scene on the ground after the shooting. And so anyway, Josh Stieber and Ethan McCord both. And I could be confusing the two, but I don't think so. Anyway, both of those guys testified on this show. It ain't quite sworn court, but both of them said on this show that they saw and heard with their own ears, saw with their own eyes, Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich ordered them specifically, and you know the others standing near them, to massacre civilians. That if an IED ever goes off, we're to kill everyone around. I want 360-degree rotational fire. Anytime anything explodes, any person you can see, kill. And then that'll teach these bastards to bomb us. And I followed up with both of those guys, and I said, now hold on now, this isn't, are you telling me you heard this somewhere? Are you telling me that the word was passed down to you from your sergeant? Or you're telling me that you saw Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich in your presence and heard with your own ears, saw with your own eyes him giving you this order to commit these war crimes against civilians? And they both said, yeah, you're damn right. They didn't slur your either. They said it right. You're damn right. And both of them said they would either shoot high or shoot low, but they would shoot. They would not deliberately kill civilians like in their orders, but they would shoot because, Jesus, otherwise they'd be in trouble, I guess. So, anyway, I'm off on a tangent. Point being, that's who David Finkel is. He's the Washington Post reporter who wrote the book about those guys. And in fact, I think Stieber and McCord are not in the book. They're on a different... I forgot how they divide all these groups now. Maybe they're all in the same brigade, but they're in a different squad, that kind of thing. These guys were in a different squad, whatever you call it. But anyway, man, I'm really bad at the tangents, but I just keep thinking of more and more stuff to say. Like, they were fighting against Sauter at the same time that the whole war was for Sauter. These guys lost their limbs, lost their best friends, committed war crimes. In their war against the Sauterists in 2007, at the same time the entire freaking war was to put the Sauterists and the Iraqi National Alliance Shiite Party in power in Baghdad. That George Bush should not just be, you know, hanged after being duly convicted. He should be chopped into little pieces for what he did. Never mind for what he did to the Iraqis. Think of what he did to the American soldiers. Imagine that. You get your legs and your testicles, your hands, your face blown off. Live like the Metallica video, one, for the rest of your short-ass, miserable life. Because you were sent out on a mission to fight against Sauter at the same time the whole war was for Sauter. Anyway, it's David Finkel, The Good Soldiers. In fact, there's two places in that book, the way I remember. There's one enlisted man going, ain't that funny how, ain't the war kind of for Sauter while we're fighting against his guys here? And there's one other part where Kozlarich, the war criminal himself, says, it is kind of ironic, isn't it, that the whole war really is for the Sauterists and the United Iraqi Alliance. Oh well, back to work, getting my guys killed and ordering war crimes. Anyway, point is, Finkel, David Finkel, the Washington Post reporter, he was on the Colbert Report last night. And he's got a new book. And the new book is about how the soldiers are a wreck, man, because of what they've been through. They're dying at their own hands because of what they've been through. And so Colbert says, well, what do we do? And Finkel says, well, you tell me. And Colbert says, well, if I knew, I wouldn't have even had you on the show. Which, man, that guy is really quick on his feet, isn't he? He's great. I mean, I get bored with him sometimes, but that's pretty damn good. And then Finkel just shrugs and says, well, you know, it'd be nice if the American people would even pay attention, right? How about that for starters? How about your government is still sending 19-year-olds over there, here, there, and everywhere else to get blown up? And it would be pleasant if people would at least pay attention. But then, what cowardice, man. Is it really so hard to say, Steven, the terror war is a bunch of crap, man. Cut the comedy routine for a second. This whole thing is a giant lie. These young men are being betrayed because the so-called adults of America will not come to grips with the fact of what they've let themselves be talked into. What they need to do is care for a minute and demand that these wars are ended. That the soldiers occupying Afghanistan, the Marines occupying Afghanistan, are brought home now. So that no more of them have to commit the kind of war crimes that make them want to commit suicide when they come home. That's the answer, Stephen. Not just pay attention. End the war. End the occupation. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you kids, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. And yeah, you know, it really does bother me that in 2013, you still can't get that much honesty out of Finkel or Colbert. This whole thing is a giant screw job. Stop laying down for it, you know? It ain't rape if you're the one sticking your ass up. So, knock it off. And you know, that's not a fair metaphor at all. Because, you know, what this all amounts to is some people volunteering others to go fight. You know? I was a teenager once. I remember being that dumb. I remember my role in the society being, at least maybe you should join the army. After all, it's advertised during every commercial break, during every football game. So if that ain't legitimacy, what is? You could be a doctor or a lawyer or join the army. Those are the three most respectable things that you could do with your entire life. Everybody knows that's great. Oh, and whether or not you should go and die in a war or not, well, listen. The adults, the responsible adults of America, participating through their democracy, will all make sure to elect leaders who would only ever send you off to war for a really, really good reason. And you might have to die in a war, but it'll only be, you know, to protect the free world from Nazism and stuff like that. And then what happens? They get sent off for Madeleine Albright or Condoleezza Rice or Hillary Clinton's fantasy. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to pick on the women. It's just those are our secretaries of state lately. I guess I could have. What? Who was Secretary of State before Albright? Warren Christopher? So Warren Christopher, Colin Powell, and John Kerry there. America's at war all over the friggin' place. Americans don't even keep, can't even keep track of where we're at war. And so to me, you know what? There are psychopath, mean 19-year-olds who only join up the military because they want a chance to kill people. All right, wartime. I don't care who it is. Just give me a permission slip to be a killer. That's all I've ever wanted out of life. There are people like that. I've known people like that in my life. I think you probably have too. Mostly, we're thankful when they join the army instead of just becoming a career criminal in our own neighborhood, right? But not most of them. The truth is, most of these kids are good kids from the football team and that kind of thing. Straight B students who do what they're supposed to. Who are under the impression that joining the military is the right thing. And who are under the impression that their government, a.k.a. their country, a.k.a. the adult, responsible, rational Americans, will only ever risk their lives when it's worth it. And the problem is that that's not true. They're still taught it. And their elders still believe it to a great degree, unfortunately. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance there. Well, me, I'm against the wars, but I'm for the army. Everybody just loves the army. That's the greatest make-work project of all. Just, oh, you can never say anything bad about the army. Boy, a member of football player tweeted last week, did you guys see this, where a football player tweeted that, I don't know, it doesn't take much skill to kill people. And then every tool in America, oh, now's my chance to prove how much I love the state. Tweeted back to him, oh yeah, well if it wasn't for the army, you wouldn't be free to be a football player. Really? What a great slogan. Now, do you have an argument at all? does anyone have an argument at all? I mean, the best you could possibly do, which would still be ridiculous, but the best you could possibly do would be say that the army protected America from world communism up through 1989, when it all began falling apart, up through 91, when the USSR entirely ceased to exist. But what's your excuse since then? That if America had allowed the military dictator of Iraq to overthrow the king of Kuwait, that I wouldn't be free? We'd all be speaking Arabic right now? Give me a break. Not even America's dumbest militarist tool would even try to argue that. They wouldn't even try. We'd all be speaking what language right now if it wasn't for this war? You know, tell me what, the terrorists would have taken over America? I got news for you. 9/11 was the last gasp, Hail Mary pass. Holy crap. Maybe, just maybe, we'll get lucky enough to figure out a way to trick and provoke the Americans into invading the Middle East and fighting us directly and bleeding themselves to death in our sand and under our mountains. They weren't coming here. They can't. Ever looked at a globe? Ever looked at the video of the attack that day? They had to hijack American civilian airliners to even have a bomb to crash into something. They don't even have a single plane of their own, America's enemies. Not one. Oh no, that was the razor's edge of the giant terrorist juggernaut come to enslave all of North America. You know, the hundreds of millions of Christians that live here under Sharia law, bin Ladenite terrorism, just like the kind that we're trying to install and power in Syria right now. Yeah, right. But you know what? Doesn't matter that everybody knows that that's stupid. Everybody knows that America's an empire. Everybody knows that the USA started it and then used the resistance as the excuse to do even more of the same that provoked the fight in the first place. But boy, you still can't say a bad word about the U.S. Army, or people start pissing and crying and freaking out. Well, anyway, when we get back, we're going to talk about how the U.S. Army, the real U.S. Army, not the one in your slogan, just overdoses their veterans with drugs to death, oftentimes, just to shut them up. Because of what service is really like and what it really does to a young man. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. We're on No Agenda Radio, 11 to 1 Eastern every day. Also streaming from scotthorton.org. 3,000 interviews now at scotthorton.org. And also join up the chat room there, scotthorton.org/chat. Man, it's a pretty small group of people today, but anyway, make it bigger. ScottHorton.org/chat. You don't need any kind of external application or anything. You just log right in, add a fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. So that's pretty cool, right? And then also I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right, enough of that. First guest today is our friend Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine and Antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Kelly. How are you doing?
Great, Scott. Congratulations that you just had 3,000 interviews.
Yep.
That's
Thank
fabulous.
You. Appreciate that.
That's wonderful.
You know, it's funny. Once I got 3,000, I thought, you know, 3 is a pretty small number. It should be more like 5 or 10,000 or something.
Hey, I'm still trying to get more than 778 connections on Twitter, followers rather. And it's like every single one I fight so hard for.
Well, you know, I lose as many as I gain. I think
I know, it's so
I'm the same on Facebook too.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the truth hurts. That's what it is. People don't like being told what's exactly right.
I know.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, so listen, let's talk about the cops executing this lady on the streets of D.C. yesterday. Whoa. And look, I know the cops shoot black people in Washington, D.C. all the time. This was notable because it was in the white part of D.C., right?
Well, I'm stymied by the whole thing, and it's very unsettling. I mean, I can tell you what I know of the facts. And I could tell you all the questions that remain.
Well, first of all, let me tell the people, you've got this blog entry at antiwar.com/blog, DC shooting, shame on you, New York Daily News. So, first of all, you're right. Let's start with the facts of the case, the best you can rehearse them for us, and then we'll get to the media criticism and the police criticism and the whatever other kind of criticism.
Okay, well, we know for sure. This is what we know for sure. A woman driving a black Lexus, a black woman with a small child in the back, had gone down the wrong road, a cordoned off area outside the White House, and hit, smashed into a security barrier. She had some sort of conversation with a plainclothes security agent. I guess it was Secret Service. She had some interaction with him. She bangs the gas, hits him. He goes over the hood of the car, rolls off. A witness says that he popped up, he was okay, but at that point she banged it in reverse, tried to turn around, in which all these other guards get involved and start shooting at her car. She panics. I mean, I'm trying not to be subjective here, but she bangs the car, turns around, and then leads them on a chase. There's a picture in the Post today of her car already riddled with bullet holes at that point. She takes the car a couple miles around and up to one of the Senate office buildings, in which there's varying degrees of blocked-off roads there. You don't know them until you turn into them. She apparently turned into one of those, so she couldn't go any further. They had her blocked off. What I heard on Fox just now, 5 minutes ago, was some indication that she never got out of the car. There's pictures that Fox is showing on their channel right now of her windows all blown out to suggest that they just shot right into the car. Miraculously, this small child that's in the back seat that they've determined it was her daughter was not hurt, and she was taken to social services. So those are the facts as we know them. Now, the police chief in D.C. says sort of cryptically that she knew it was no accident that this woman had hit the security barrier, but she doesn't give any details. So one would think that perhaps this woman who was maybe in some sort of state, we don't know, had turned down a wrong road outside that White House. They're super, super sensitive. There's tons of security there since 9/11. She hit a security barrier. The guard gets involved. Maybe she was angry for some reason. Maybe it sparked some sort of, you know, angry interaction. She panicked and left. We don't know. But the suggestion in the media that there was a crazed woman that somehow was attacking the White House, was ramming the barriers trying to get in, I believe is very irresponsible and, as far as we know now, not truthful. And that's why I wrote that blog post, because I find that in this rush to sort of fulfill this Washington under siege narrative that the media has fallen into, the cops first instinct or the first storyline that they're putting out there that there was a mentally ill woman on the loose in Washington yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the first lesson of this thing is what tiny cowards the Congress is, where they all stood up and cheered for this thing because...
Yeah.
As you can just tell, their imagination is running wild. Oh,
yeah.
I heard that the cops protected us from something. Well, that
right.
something must have been really, really dangerous.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and I'm going to give, and I hate to do this, but I'll give the cops the benefit of the doubt. I mean, the Congress, members of Congress, the benefit of the doubt. They're held up, you know, in lockdown in the Capitol or their office buildings, whatever, you know, under some idea or some fear that there is a terrorist attack outside because they don't know any different. So, and then they hear that the, you know, the suspect has been put down. You know, they're probably imagining some real bad guy, you know, who is about to bomb them has been taken out by the cops, and they immediately, you know, start applauding. I'm not saying that that was a good reaction or not. I hate to think that they were clapping because a 34-year-old black woman with a child in the back seat got shot, killed, dead. You know, but the fear in this town is palpable, and rumors fly.
And that's the
and
thing.
So,
it's not that there are real threats. It's that their consciences are that guilty. They know that, well, geez, if fair was fair, we would all be in a world of hurt. Somebody be coming for us.
Well, and think of it, Scott. You spend like 70% of your time on Capitol Hill preparing for the next terrorist attack, the next war. And you're constantly funding money for a war that's either not happening or has already ended or could happen. And then the other percent of the time you're holding hearings about Al-Shabaab and their threat to Americans and homegrown threats and lone gunmen and lone wolf threats. I mean... And security and cameras and you know, and so it's almost like a wish fulfillment. When
right.
something like this happens, you immediately go, well, it's happening for real now. Everybody duck, cover, shelter in place. A week or two right after what happened at the Navy Yard. You know, shelter in place. People, you know, honestly, if I had been on the Hill yesterday, I literally got on the Metro a few moments before this happened. But if I had been at the Capitol a few more minutes later, I would have been scared. I mean, I would immediately thought of the Navy Yard and ducked for cover.
Yeah.
So I mean, I can understand that.
I guess. See, I don't live in D.C. I live here, where whenever I hear something like this, I assume it's just that the cops are killing somebody, and then they're making up an excuse about what a giant, terrible danger the person was that they felt like killing. Which is how I mean, on my Facebook feed. This is all I get every day, where every local news story of a cop massacring somebody or, you know, blowing someone away for no good reason becomes a national news story on my Facebook feed all day, every day, you know?
Yeah, and
so that's always my assumption is they're just killing somebody and then they're crying, oh, boo-hoo, I had to do it, because that's what they always cry.
Well, that, you know, and I'm concerned that this narrative coming out that this woman was mentally disturbed is going to take precedence over any demands for questions about the actual details. So I've been watching on and off, you know, cable news, unfortunately, all morning. And, you know, MSNBC already is, you know, they've been interviewing all these so-called, you know, crime experts who are going on there assuming this woman had a mental illness. And they're doing these long segments about mental illness and how it leads to, you know, would-be presidential assassination.
Oh, God.
And so it's already forming in our minds.
But meanwhile, all the evidence, as you, at least the way I understand it too, and as you rehearsed it for us here, all the evidence is that this lady accidentally made a wrong turn. She was confronted by a plainclothes officer who freaked out on her in full Nazi drill sergeant mode. And so she panicked and backed up and or tried to turn around. You know, when I watched a clip of this yesterday on Live Leak, of her being chased around and whatever. When the clip was over, LiveLeak suggested that three or four more videos of woman driver, you know, being terrible. And I just thought, you know what, that's the LiveLeak algorithm or whatever, but it makes perfect sense. And like, you know what? And there are men who are bad drivers too, but I think this started out as a bad case of woman driver, which the cops then escalated, where, as you said, when she's pulling away from the initial incident, the pictures in the Washington Post show they were already shooting at her.
Yes.
And then
yes.
Now, oh, stop resisting, when they're shooting at her and her car with a baby in it. So
yes.
Then, after everything from that point on is her frantically trying to get away from these killers, these insane madmen and their firearms, which are going off.
And,
I mean,
and you know what?
Damn.
There's no evidence to the contrary. We don't know anything right now. And I try to make that clear in my post, because who knows what's going to come out 10 minutes from now.
Sure, but that, they're willing to speculate all they want, assuming
exactly.
Some guilt on her part, when clearly, so far, all indications are she simply made a wrong turn, and then they completely freaked out on her, and she completely freaked out in response. Right?
Yeah. You know what? And I have to say this. After 9/11, you know, and I'm sure you felt the same, you know, wherever you are, especially in places like New York and Washington, you know, the police are a lot less patient with people. And if you take a wrong turn or you say the right thing or you cross the street at the wrong time, they're very aggressive and very gruff. I've had similar, not serious encounters, but where I felt like if I had just stepped one foot in the wrong direction or said the wrong thing at that very moment, that I might be turned around and had handcuffs on me. I am very careful how I tread around the police in Washington, D.C., because they, after 9/11, there's a sense of fear, and there's a sense of, you know, everyone is a criminal until proven innocent. And, you know, you don't fool around with that. And so I would not be surprised if somebody, a tourist, an out-of-towner comes in and they go down a wrong road. There are so many wrong ways and closed-off roads in that area around the White House that, you have to tread lightly. And if you're already, you know, maybe she was in a state. We don't know why she was even there. Her family didn't even know she went to Washington. So if she was already in a sensitive, agitated state, and then some guy, like you said, starts banging on her car and screaming at her, and she might have had a bad reaction, that sets off. That sets off a, and you read it all the time. You said you get these feeds about cops killing people. It sets out a reaction that you can't stop.
Yeah.
And clearly this one didn't only stop when she was dead.
Well, and the thing is, too, I guess I'm just old enough now to remember the discrepancy between at least the theory that a cop's job is to protect the rights of the suspect, on the theory that if they're really guilty, the townspeople are going to come for their ass for doing something so bad that you would have to arrest them for it. And then the cop's job is actually simply protecting the rights of the accused until they can get their fair trial. That's why we keep them in a cage, is to keep everybody else away, kind of thing. And maybe that's sort of mythical, but at least the theory being, right, that these public servants, their job is protecting the rights of the accused and having a minimal approach to force, right? Only as much as is absolutely necessary. And yet it's in my lifetime that the big change came, starting with Waco. And it's really the Colin Powell doctrine, which is you win your war within a week. You shock and awe and you bomb all of their ports and their airports and their water and their food and their command and control and their palaces and their everything, and you win the war. You don't get bogged down into a Vietnam. You blast the hell out of them and win fast. Overwhelming force where they dare not even try to resist. And they take that same Powell doctrine and they use it for every SWAT raid now, and every warrant is a SWAT raid now. And of course, it's the same thing for enforcing traffic laws in Washington, D.C., right?
Right,
not
right.
The assumption is not, hey, this confused lady needs a helping hand. It's, now's my chance to act like a screaming Nazi drill sergeant and force someone to obey me. Because that's their whole attitude. That overwhelming force and intimidation is their entire attitude from beginning to end. And then, lo and behold, they're shocked when it doesn't work. And they end up killing the lady and then calling themselves heroes. I mean, that's the quote in the Washington Post. Was, all these cops acted heroically for shooting this woman in front of her tiny child.
Well, you know, one of the best examples that I like to give, and it's somewhat humorous, is last year I went to a Christmas play with my daughter's first grade class, the majority of which are little girls, and there was like three, you know, vans, suburban mom vans, and a convoy with all these little girls, and we were on a campus at a university here, and we took a wrong turn. And all of a sudden, this campus police officer comes out of nowhere yelling at us like we were about to storm the gates and wreak havoc all over this campus. You can imagine, three, you know, bands filled with women and children, and this guy comes out blazing. And we're like, dude, we just don't know where to park.
Yeah, well, and you're lucky you didn't kill anybody. Seriously.
It's a culture. Like you have just described a militarized culture of the police in the United States, and it trickles all the way down to your local Mayberry police departments and your campus police departments, especially the campus police departments, because as you remember, the pepper spray incident of a couple years ago where they just, you know, the overactive steroidal cops on campus who wish to be, you know, New York City Police Department but never made the cut are like, you know, terrorizing college students.
Well, and they know there's no accountability, so they can do whatever they want.
They
guy got fired just because he became globally famous or whatever, but
yeah.
For most of them, you kill somebody and unarm somebody, shoot them in the back even. You get 2 weeks paid vacation and then probably a promotion after that, you know?
Well, you
they'll sing
the
he's a jolly good fellow.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that, you know, like you said, that you get these feeds every day about this, and I follow this website, copblock.com, and they constantly feed all of the incidents, you know, daily of police brutality and shootings, and the majority of Americans don't pay attention. You know, they put their head down, they say, if I'm doing everything right and I'm not committing any crime, then I have nothing to worry about. You know, but they, you know, but it's getting to the point where everybody knows somebody who came up on the wrong side of a police officer at some point in the last few years.
Yeah. I know a guy who, you know, years ago now had the full-scale, ninja armor, machine gun, SWAT raid over a little bit of pot at his house. And this guy still has nightmares and his, you know, PTSD or where. I mean, it's really bad, right? They're screaming and cussing, and I couldn't, you know, recreate it on the radio the way they screamed or whatever without blowing your ears out. But they terrorize the hell out of this guy over just, and this goes on as Radley Balco has documented. Yeah. This goes on 200 times a day in America. There's a SWAT raid like this. So, you know, you can imagine the losers on the D.C., park police, traffic cops or whatever, standing around wishing they were SWAT soldiers. You know, now's their chance when a lady makes a wrong turn. They get to act like a hero now, too. Look at how heroic we are executing this woman.
Yeah. And I, you know what, Scott, I get it. I get it if the first thing they thought of was, you know, oh my goodness, this is a woman or this is a driver that's about to trying to careen in with a trunk full of explosives. It's happened, you know, and it's in their minds. It's why they have those barriers up in the first place. And after what happened at the Navy Yard, yeah, I'm sure that was in their minds too. But then there's the other question. Why didn't they blow out her tires? Why'd they have to shoot inside the car like that? Why didn't they wait for her to get out and then clearly see that she was unarmed? If they knew,
why didn't they call the bomb squad to clear out and make sure her trunk was okay to open when they're searching it? Where I saw pictures of just plain clothes cops standing around. They weren't afraid of her car, that it might have been a bomb. Certainly not after they were done killing her. I guess at least at that point they realized that this is just some lady.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, we don't know. Maybe she did go down there to have a chat with the president. We don't know yet. My beef is this narrative that's being created that she was a mentally ill woman out to attack the White House. It's bothersome to me because it shrouds the pursuit of the truth in this case.
Right. And well, as always, officials say instead of officials claim, you know? And so then the theory is that it must be right, you know?
Oh, yeah, because there's a story on NBC News this morning that officials, law enforcement sources say, that she thought Obama was stalking her. Now, why haven't I seen that anywhere else on the news? I mean, even Fox wasn't reporting that this morning. So what it's telling me is somebody was floating something around. Now, whether until I could see some proof of that, I'm thinking that it was just part of some cover story. And who are these law enforcement sources?
Yeah. Anyway, and you know what?
The media operates on this sort of like real time. I got to get the scoop. I got to put it up on Twitter. I got to put it up. You know, you got to get it out there on the graphic on MSNBC or Fox immediately, and then check the facts later.
Right. And got to always take the state side, no matter what, ever.
Yeah. Sources say. I mean, it happened with the Boston bombing as well.
Yep.
All
right, now, we really spent too much time on this one. I want to let you talk about the prescription drug story, and at least, you know, give it a good recommendation for, well, we still got 8 minutes, so eight minutes or so. For you to talk about this story in the American Conservative magazine. It's called The Military's Prescription Drug Addiction. And this is a really important story here, Kelly.
Yeah, and it's a real sad one, too. And, I had been watching this since about 2009, 2010, when the first story started coming out that indicated that a large percentage, and I think at the time it was like 1 in 6 of active duty troops, many of them deployed, we're on some psychotropic, you know, prescription drug for whether it be, you know, sleeplessness because of nightmares, depression, you know, so they're, you know, depression, antipsychotics, bipolar. So 1 in 6. Now they're active duty, and now we're getting a sense that they come home, they continue to be medicated. We have a veterans population that's heavily medicated, whether it be, you know, a lot of these guys come home and they have both PTSD. They might also have traumatic brain injury. They might also have some other sort of chronic pain, bad back or whatever. They go to the VA and they're given like a handful of pills, and not even a handful. I've heard of some cases where some guys are on 20 to 40 pills a day. So they come home and they are addicted to prescription medication. And so there's two issues stemming from that I write about. One are the suicides. We know that the suicide rate has spiked among active duty as well as veterans. Now, our first inclination is that these guys have PTSD from combat, but more and more evidence is coming out that half of these guys never even saw combat, but most of them are suffering from some sort of mental problem. So the assumption is that most of these guys or a good percentage of them were on some sort of medication when they committed suicide. So there's questions being raised now about the level of prescriptions they are, the kind of prescriptions, because we know that some antidepressants have, you know, been fingered for having side effects of suicidal thoughts and aggression and anger. And so that there's some question about whether that's causing these suicides. There's question about whether in this, the other branch of my story, are the untimely accidental deaths that are occurring both in the military and among veterans who are on these medications. There's one medication, Seroquel, that is an antipsychotic that the military has been prescribing for sleeplessness, even though the FDA has only approved it for bipolar and schizophrenia. So they, you know, but thousands, tens of thousands of these guys were, I think it was 52,000 prescriptions in 2011 alone were prescribed this very powerful antipsychotic for sleeplessness. And I guess it was working because when they came home, and the VA started, you know, prescribing it. And so this has been known to cause cardiac arrest. So you have a number, and the total number is elusive because the VA and the DOD is not free and easy with their numbers. But an alarming number of these veterans and active duty guys have been dying in their sleep. Turns out they're on a cocktail of these drugs. And Seroquel is just one that's being blamed for it. So it's a really important issue that we need to keep our eye on because it's affecting an entire generation of veterans who, you know, have flooded these VAs. Many of them have multi-injuries, multi-wounds, head and body, and the first instinct is to put them on pills. And so this affects everybody. It affects the taxpayer, it affects our communities, it affects our families, and they're calling it a crisis. So I'm trying to keep on it because it's one of those stories that, you know, could kind of slip under the radar unless you're paying attention. So I'm happy that you took a look at it on the American Conservative.
Yeah, no, it's a really important story, and, you know, some of the statistics that you just cited there and elaborate on in the article are really mind-blowing. And
yeah.
Of course, it makes perfect sense, right, if you had decided to sit around and predict this 7 years ago or something like this, this is what you would have come up with. Well, so what's the government to do when a bunch of guys come home and at least they're nervous wrecks or, you know, if they're not, they got one problem or another, anxiety or depression or guilt or post-traumatic stress or whatever. What's the government going to do about that? Here, eat this pill. Of course, that, you know, what are they going to do? Get them the cutting edge of talk therapy or whatever, you know, that's come up with. And you know, notably, you have in your article, you know, people actually involved not in making the big paperwork decisions at the top, but actually involved in delivering the care to the patients. You know what? A lot of these guys don't need pills, especially a lot of them are very active guys. They're athletic types, and they want to go out hiking and whatever, and you want to drug them into a stupor. They're not going to even take the pills. So they're going to go on with their problem as it is, when what they really need is to talk with somebody about their feelings about what happened there. This is one of the things that David Finkel was talking about on the Colbert Report last night, was that years later, these guys look back at some of the things that they did and who they were, how they acted, the attitudes that they had while they were in combat, and they can't get their head around. They can't reconcile how evil they became, basically kicking in people's doors, doing the job that Rumsfeld sent them on out there, with who they really are, who they were before, and who they are again now. And that's part of what causes such problems, but you can kind of work that out. You don't have to eat your old service revolver over it, you know what I mean, or your old gun, a pistol over it. You can, you know, maybe get through it, but if they just give you depressants, as you're saying, some of these guys are just dying in their sleep of the depressants that they're given to calm their anxiety. It's just a travesty is what it is. It's just what you'd have predicted.
They're heavily doped up, and a lot of them don't want to be, and that's why they're pursuing alternative medicine. I mean, it's a big problem, and I want to write more about it.
Please do, Kelly. And everyone, please go look at this great article at theamericanconservative.com, theamericanconservative.com, The Military's Prescription Drug Addiction. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, we'll be right back with Michael Bolden after this.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
That was awesome. The new 10th Amendment Center commercial in its new time. That's right, the Scott Horton Show, now sponsored by the 10th Amendment Center. And here's its founder and dear leader, Michael Bolden. Welcome to the show.
Awesome to be here, Scott. Really happy to finally be able to sponsor the show.
Well, thanks very much, because the show sure as hell appreciates it as much as the show can possibly appreciate a thing. I tell you what.
And we sure as hell appreciate the show. So we started this new campaign, as you just heard in that ad. That's the first time I've actually heard it aired anywhere, so I'm really excited about it. Over at offnow.org, we want to find ways that we can effectively push back against the NSA. Instead of waiting for Congress to stop them or the NSA to decide to be good guys or the executive branch or the courts or whatever to stop them, we want to find ways that we can actually resist them, cause them so many problems that it makes it difficult for them to pull off what they do. And you are actually the first person. I know I mentioned an email, but I want everyone to know you were the first one that I thought of for this sponsorship as we're building our campaigns to get the word out on this. So, again, very excited. And thanks for asking me to be on to talk about it today.
Cool. Well, hey, I'm flattered and honored and all that. I think that's great. And I sure do appreciate having y'all. And look, I just love the whole idea of the 10th Amendment Center and all that you guys have accomplished. And, of course, there's just the headline from last week about Jerry Brown, the governor of California, signing a nullification of the National Defense Authorization Act. So let's talk about that. And this is not just, a libertarian has an idea. There's some real momentum to work with here. This 10th Amendment Center project of yours, Michael, is not no big deal.
Well, I mean, it's pretty awesome what's happening to see this bill, Assembly Bill 351. We worked relentlessly on this with a wide coalition. This was a group of people that probably would normally hate each other, consider each other political enemies in every respect of the word. People like 99% Coalition, Occupy groups, CARE, Tea Party, Republican groups, ACLU, 10th Amendment Center, Oath Keepers, Libertarian Party, all set aside their differences to have regular meetings in private, conference calls, strategy sessions, and worked relentlessly for about 15 months to lobby, starting at a local level in Southern and Northern California on local communities to pass resolutions supporting this action. And then when the bill was introduced by a Republican in the Assembly, Tim Donnelly, to work to lobby, to show up at Assembly committee hearings, and on and on. And it passed 71-1 in the Assembly, 37-0 in the state Senate. I actually thought Jerry Brown was going to veto it because it was taking a stance against the federal government. What it does is it creates a state policy that the state of California will not put any resources or participate in any way in the implementation, not only of indefinite detention under NDAA, but as the wording of the bill says, any federal law which purports to authorize indefinite detention. So it's future-proof, and it's a very strong first step by saying, hey, we're going to say no to this, to rendering that law null and void. And as we've seen in the past, people like Rosa Parks have proven that when you say no, you can create a movement and change the world.
Right. Well, and especially when anybody can tell you that that's wrong. What do you mean the military arrest people and hold them without trial for the rest of their lives? This is
right.
America.
Well.
Right? I mean, who could argue with that other than Lindsey Graham or somebody?
Well, yeah. There's a few, and they like that kind of power, and they don't want people to know that they can actually do something about it. They want us to waste all of our time calling Congress in the hope that federal employees are going to limit federal power, and that just never happens. I think the only way that you can actually get something effective done is to resist, to say no, to use your horrible state government, like here in California, which doesn't ever do really anything good, but find a way to pressure it to work with a coalition of people that might normally not be your friend, and get it to do something good and to stand in between and, you know, protect a little liberty once in a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think historically there have been a few occasions and some pretty important things where the national government has been better on individual liberty than the state governments. And so people just tend to think of it that way, where, like, if a local cop kills somebody, especially, you know, maybe a racial minority or something, the idea immediately is to appeal to the national government, Justice Department, to have the Civil Rights Division review it, something like that, rather than we're going to really ride herd on our local district attorney and make sure that if there's an indictable case of murder of one of us by one of the cops, that they are indicted and that the case is seen through. And where it seems to me, which what the hell do I know, Michael, you tell me, but it seems to me like really people have a lot more power on that local level or even the state level than they have at the national level. They might have got lucky here or there one time with the Miranda decision or something like that. But for the most part, you'd have rolling the dice, a way better chance of influencing your state or your local government than the national government to actually intervene to protect you. In fact, look at what we're talking about here, the National Security Agency, Big Brother himself.
Sir, I mean, think about it. New Mexico didn't invade Iraq or Afghanistan, and it didn't run raids in Panama or wage war against Colombia for a few decades. It hasn't been doing that, and neither is South Carolina. There's bad stuff that happens on a state level, but I often would say that a lot of that actually, while I do believe in individual responsibility, so that local cop who kills someone, they've done a horrible moral wrong, committed an atrocity. But if you really follow the money, a lot of the problems with local police, you can actually trace back to the federal government, DHS grants, asset forfeiture. There's a whole organization, Institute for Justice, that follows the policing for profit. The fact that when the local police help the feds enforce things like the unconstitutional drug war, for example, they get millions and millions of dollars for playing part in that. And they don't really have to do this. And that really kind of leads into our whole project against NSA. As the ad was saying, places like the new Utah data center, well, they really require a lot of water to operate. There's some physical limitations. Without being able to cool those supercomputers can't stay on and store the data and do all the processing needed to spy on every human being on Earth. Well, that water is being supplied by the state of Utah, and Utah does not have to participate in that. This is based off the legal doctrine known as anti-commandeering. And it's a very rare thing to find the so-called legal experts all across the political spectrum, left, right, and middle, all agreeing on something. But this is one of them. It's the principle that the federal government cannot require state or local governments to actually carry out their laws, their regulations, their plans, whatever it may be. And it's been backed up in a ton of court cases all the way back from the 1840s, where the federal government couldn't require the states to carry out federal slavery laws in the 1842 Prigg case, all the way up to 2012. There's been three modern cases. I mean, if you want to get into that stuff, we can talk about it. But the principle is there. They can't force you to do this. And whether it's Utah providing the water to the new NSA data center or the state of Texas, San Antonio is actually the provider of the electricity for the massive new one opening up in Texas. Simply turn the power off, turn the water off. Sure, the feds might find a way to do it themselves, but we know that from their own documents going back to 2006, the NSA is extremely worried about a shortage in resources. They've put out information that said, hey, they can't continue their so-called critical mission if they don't find new resources in places like Utah and Texas.
Well, so I was going to say, but supremacy clause. But I think you're telling me that the courts already agree with you that the states have the right to stand. You're telling me the federal courts have ruled that the states have the right to stand up against the federal government. In what context? Because obviously there are a lot of contexts where they don't, apparently.
Well, in any context at all, they don't have to participate with the federal government. The courts never rule that the state can actually physically interpose and block the federal government from doing something like arresting a federal agent, even though I think in principle that would be, that's not necessarily incorrect because these people are committing crimes. All those NSA agents, they're criminals, really. But in every situation this has come up, it's the 1842 Prigg case. The Supreme Court ruled that the states didn't have to carry out federal slavery laws for the feds. In 1992, the New York case, the city of New York did not have to enact federal waste removal regulations. In 1997, that's the Prince case for Sheriff Mack, the locals didn't have to carry out federal gun control measures. And in the 2012, the Sebelius case, that's Obamacare, the states did not have to implement, I think it was Medicaid expansion, even under the threat of losing federal funding. So over and over and over, and it doesn't matter if it's someone from Think Progress or the Cato Institute who are both talking about this exact principle on C-SPAN, they all agree that no one has to participate. And I think this is a great model that should be used not only against NSA and NDAA indefinite detention, but should be used against war. I know, Scott, you and I, we've talked in interviews in the past about this Defend the Guard legislation where, you know, the state should stop handing over the National Guard troops to the federal government to invade other countries. It should be used against the drug war and everything in between.
Right. Well, and I actually haven't been keeping up with that well enough at all. It was the real movement was up in Maine to try to really do something about that. Were they successful? Do you know?
No. And we really try to put the word out on there. But I think when you're talking about resisting military actions like this, it takes a really strong left-right coalition. And unfortunately, right. I don't see much from the left, at least the mainstream left, opposing military action overseas in Libya and things like that.
It's hard with Democrats in power, of course. But, you know,
yeah, it's a weird thing.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying before about the coalition that came together in California on the NDAA thing. You know, no offense, but I think it was a little bit overstated about these groups should hate each other. I guess maybe the Occupy and the Tea Party might think that they should hate each other or something. But basically, the groups that you all listed off were the out groups on the left and the right. And nobody really horrible, the communists and the Nazis or anything like that. But just the people on the left and the right who I would term the good left and the right, the kind of people who can form a coalition against indefinite detention, against spying, against war, for peace in the Bill of Rights, to put it simply, with libertarianism as the real center rather than, you know, Obama-style conservative Democrats and McCain-style liberal Republicans as the center, but with people like you and me as the center, forging the coalition between the Mother Jonesons and the WorldNet Dalians that, like, hey, we all don't want to live in a nightmarish totalitarian future, do we? Nah. Of course not. Come on. We can do this. We can realign. And that's really what you're doing here is you're actually realigning left and right, and you're realigning up and down in this country too, and getting back to, you know, actual federalism as compared to what we call federalism now, which is nationalism.
Well, what was cool was to see how that grassroots coalition played out in the state legislature, because you don't have necessarily just the extremes or the outliers in the California Assembly and Senate, and the guy who introduced it is considered the most extreme anti-immigrant Tea Party guy. He's a Minuteman guy, and a lot of the people on the left can't stand him. They think he's a horrible guy. And then the guy who sponsored it in the Senate, Mark Leno, is the far-left guy. But it wasn't just those two guys on the extreme supposedly supporting it. It was everyone in the middle, too. They were making jokes like, hey, you know, you're going to lose your job, Senator Leno, by supporting a bill by this guy Donnelly. But they all came together and recognized that, look, this kind of stuff, indefinite detention, this is kidnapping, really. This is a crime. It's unconstitutional. They shouldn't be doing it. And everybody supported it except one. I don't know who that was, though.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is the Supreme Court, we actually have a history here in America. It's not ancient. It's only a couple hundred years, but we got some, and a lot of stuff has happened, and the courts have ruled on this before, and they said, no, everybody gets a civilian trial unless the civilian courts aren't even open for business because the war's so bad. Otherwise, bring them before me, and I'll decide, say the judges.
Yeah, I just don't trust those guys anyway.
Well, I don't either, but I trust them a lot better than a colonel to decide, you know, no habeas corpus whatsoever. Of course, the way it works now, like in Guantanamo, they get rid of habeas corpus. They go before the judge. The judge says, yeah, you make a pretty good case. Okay, you're free to go. And then the military and the president still refuse to release them anyway.
Yeah, and I actually saw from Tangerine Boland, she had written a report about the case where Judge Forrest actually ruled that it was unconstitutional, and then it was overturned in the next level of the court. But she had questioned some of the federal attorneys on this after she issued an injunction blocking indefinite detention. She specifically asked the federal attorneys, hey, are you guys doing this in defiance of my order, my injunction? And they refused to answer. So that tells me that even when the courts tell them not to do something, they don't care. I mean, just like you were saying, they don't care. They're going to do what they want.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we kind of assume that it's been since Padilla or Almari or somebody where a U.S. person was abducted and held by the Fed, by the military this way or whatever. But then again, it's all secret, so we don't really know that.
No, and they don't want us to know, and that's part of why they treat us all as enemies. That's why the NSA is spying on their enemies, everybody. And that's why we really want to push back hard with this new campaign over at offnow.org. There was a really interesting press release that I found that was reported on by the Baltimore Sun back in 2006, and this kind of formed the basis for our project. And there was a point in time in 2006 where at Fort Meade, I think it is, their headquarters in Maryland, they maxed out the power grid in Baltimore. They actually put out information to the local media that said, hey, if we don't find new places for power, we're in big trouble. As I mentioned before, they refer to it as their critical mission. They can't continue it or expand it. So there is a serious issue there. They went to Texas specifically with the San Antonio data center that's opening because Texas has an independent power grid. They went to Utah specifically because of cheap resources. They're expanding in Colorado, in Augusta, Georgia. In Georgia, the city of Augusta is providing the waste treatment, the sewage treatment, the water, the electricity.
It's a lot of openings.
Stuff that's happening.
It's a lot of places to hit them. All right, now hold on right there. We got to take a very short break, and we'll be right back, everybody, with Michael Bolden from the 10th Amendment Center. That's 10thamendmentcenter.com. And, man, they're at a Nullify NSA and offnow.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Michael Bolden from the 10th Amendment Center. And let me try and see if I can get this right here for a second. 10thamendmentcenter.com. Not the number. I bet it probably forwards if you use the number, but just write it out. 10thamendmentcenter.com. And then there, you can follow Nullify NSA on Twitter. And you can like them on Facebook, and you can find them at nullifynsa.com and at offnow.org. And when we were interrupted by the commercial break, Michael was going down the list of vulnerable places where the free American citizenry operating through their local democratic institutions can apply pressure to limit the power of the national government to tap all our phones and read all our minds.
Yeah, think about that. I mean, the NSA obviously needs electricity, and they're not getting it from solar yet. So in the meantime, let's say some state legislator there in Texas for the next session introduced our model legislation, which you find over at offnow.org, nullifynsa.com. It's technically the same URL, but we'll figure that out later on. Let's say someone introduces the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, which would ban the state from providing that electricity. Well, what's the federal government going to do? What's the NSA going to do? They're going to have a real problem on their hands, even if they're able to sue the state and somehow overturn all these Supreme Court decisions on anti-commandeering. Well, this is going to cause a lot of disruptions and issues for the NSA, and I'd like to see that happen not only in Texas but in Utah, in Georgia, in Tennessee, in Maryland, in Hawaii, Colorado, at Yakima, Washington, all over the country this stuff is happening. But even in the areas that there aren't actual physical NSA locations, you can still get this type of legislation introduced on a state or a local level because the NSA is now funneling through the DEA's Special Operations Division. It's called SOD. All this warrantless information for the investigation and prosecution of day-to-day crimes, primarily drug war stuff that they shouldn't be involved in the first place. And the local and state legislation would ban local and state law enforcement from being able to use that type of information. Whether they follow it or not is another story, but it's at least a first step, like what happened here in California against NDAA and other indefinite detention with the signing of AB 351. It really creates momentum. It empowers people that they can actually do something. And again, Rosa Parks shows us they know can change things.
Man, you know, Michael, I got to say, I think that's the most important place where we have to push back is the National Security Agency funneling this information to domestic police agencies, federal and state. And this is where, you know, this is the line, man. This is the Rubicon. This is where we could get way, way out of control here, where the entire NSA apparatus is turned against the American people as individuals, right? No more predicates for crimes anymore. A giant fishing expedition on every single one of us, and in order to haul us into criminal court. That is what we have not been faced with yet, but that is, as you're saying, so far they're laundering it through the DEA, special operations, this and that. But imagine if that was just wholesale, where the NSA, the state and local police, and the FBI, all the domestic police agencies, the IRS, everybody, where all of their computers are integrated, and the orders are going from the top down. The camera on your highway reading your license plate is turning you into the IRS, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, man, this could get really wicked really quickly.
Well, this kind of stuff is actually already happening in some limited use. So, for example, here in Los Angeles, there's a great coalition led by a guy named Hamid Khan called the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition. And one of the big things that they're pushing back on is suspicious activity reporting. Basically, what you're saying, they're getting information back and forth with the FBI, DHS, and probably NSA and the DEA. And it's basically anything, anywhere. It could be the camera on your vehicle, on the highways, or if you're sitting on a bus, people are supposed to report you doing something wrong with your camera. They're supposed to take a picture and send it in. I mean, this is crazy type stuff that is happening. They probably do trial run here in L.A. or something and want to roll it out to the rest of the country. But, yeah, you're right. This is where it can go absolutely nuts if people don't resist. And I'm not talking about resisting by making just a phone call about a bill, but eventually it's going to have to come down to people taking actions like turning the power off, that it seems like a serious confrontation in order to stop these people.
Yeah. Well, you know, Neil Postman wrote in his book Technopoly that in America, it's the complete surrender of culture to technology, and that any gadget that can be invented will be invented and will be implemented as soon as it's cheap enough to be implemented. Witness, for example, the cameras everywhere, where they never held a single vote. They just put them up as soon as it was cheap enough to put them up. That kind of thing. But it seems to me like there's actually quite a bit of reason for hope that the kind of, you know, we sort of swing back and forth, and it seems like we're swinging back toward Jeffersonianism a little bit here in American culture, and a little bit of pushback, and a little bit of the philosophy of liberty pushing through. That, like, man, are we really going to give up what we believed anyway, even if it was a lie, what we believed was this great free society and move into East German style thing without a fight at all, just because they can do it, or, you know, but it seemed, I don't know. Anyway, I'm trying to say that I'm optimistic. I think the 10th Amendment Center itself is a reason to be optimistic in a way that it's, you know, they do have unlimited technology, but we also have human spirits and stuff, so it's not over yet.
Yeah. Yeah, love of liberty and that coalition that came together, that really does give me hope. It actually can bring me to tears a little bit when thinking about it, because this is what our real political enemies want us to treat our neighbors like our enemies. And when we resist that pressure, we can actually get things done. We can move forward, and hopefully that'll be an example for people around the rest of the country.
All right, now, so talk for 1 minute about how people can get involved in this thing.
Offnow.org. We're running campaigns to get legislation introduced. We've got commitments from legislators in three states already. We just started to introduce a Fourth Amendment Protection Act, but you can go get the model legislation, learn how this all plays out, find which corporations are partnering with the NSA, find out who maybe you should start boycotting, for example, and, of course, financially, if you want to contribute, help us run more ads and things like that, that all those links are there on the website.
That's great. Again, offnow.org. And again, for people just tuning in, it's Michael Bolden from the 10th Amendment Center. NullifyNSA.com, offnow.org, and they need your help to push this thing, model legislation to get your state to push back, to push up against the national government, and they're the newest sponsor of this show. And isn't that great news? So please go and check out offnow.org, and thank you, Michael Bolden, for your time on the show and for your cooperation, sir.
Awesome. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks. All right. This is the Scott Horton Show. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. We're on No Agenda Radio and ScottHorton.org/listen. Join up the chat room if you like. ScottHorton.org/chat, and then you can chat with people. It'll be great. You guys have liking the show in common, or at least wanting to pay attention to it. Maybe some people hate it. I don't listen anyway. Anyway, so hey, if you want my full treatment on the left-right thing, go and watch my speech at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. The one at the Ron Paul thingamajig. And in fact, thanks to Jason Rink, I finally have the good version of that. I used to have one. It was pretty good, but it was just from really far away. And Jason Rink had the better version of the video of that speech. It's up there at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. And so I talk about the realignment and kind of give it the full treatment there. But let me just say for... this is not going to blow your mind or anything. I just, yeah, for the record, it's important to me. I think maybe I mentioned recently that I said this something along these lines on my very first radio show back in 1998 on Free Radio Austin, that I think that the best of the left and the best of the right, despite their cultural differences and their old grudges and their suspicions of each other and what have you, actually could compromise and, you know, could, if they open their minds, could see each other as their most important allies in at least stopping all of the worst of the most horrible stuff. Doesn't mean everybody's going to get their way. A good thing about being a libertarian is I don't want to get my way. I just want for everyone else to stop getting their way too, basically. At least through force, you know. I don't have my own agenda I'm pushing except stopping doing stuff. The government stopping doing stuff. I don't have a proactive agenda. And I know people on the left and the right, they do. They got a list of things that they want the state to do for them. And you know what? Boy, oh boy, do they come at loggerheads sometimes about what? Management and labor and country and rock and roll and Christians versus secularists and hippies versus cowboys and whatever. But the thing of it is this. Here's what's most important. Being free so that you can pursue happiness. So, how are you going to live in a free society if you live in a totalitarian society? Right, you're not. So really, never mind how other people are living for a minute. How about we just focus on what our government is doing and getting away with? Because as we can see at guardian.com/NSA files. Boy, oh boy, did they have the technology to create a slave state that George Orwell could never have conceived of. At the time, he wrote 1984 back in 1947. Published it in 48. That's why I call it 84, 48, 84. Get it? Anyway. He could have never imagined the extent of the surveillance that they can apply to us. And, in fact, there's a great article in the dang on Guardian. It's got, you know, obviously a British slant on it, what this all means to the Brits rather than the Americans. But anyway, it's extremely relevant. And I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me anymore. But it's at the Guardian. It's in the NSA files at the Guardian. And it's a novelist who the Guardian sent to New York to go through all the Snowden documents. He read through them all. And he actually, and this is useful, I don't mind that I disagree with him, and you should neither mind disagreeing with him, that he says, listen, whatever they're doing to the foreign enemies, I don't care. Whatever degree of spying they're doing or targeting bad guys or whatever, I believe in all the bad guys they say are bad, and I believe that I need them to be my security force. That's the bottom line of the article to start, is whatever GCHQ and the NSA have on everyone else on Earth, fine. But what they're doing to the Brits is what's of concern to me. That's what he writes, you know? What they're doing at home. And the thing of it is, they have the ability, as Bolden was just referring to, they really do, and the way he lists, it sounds like it's not true. I'm sorry, I know it does, right? This sounds like things that little kids are saying to each other, rumors of what they think they heard the adults talking about or something, but that is a gross exaggeration. But no, really. They can hit a button and put together a file on you that includes your phone, your TV channel, your video games. That's in there. From what time to what time do you log into your Sony machine to play video games? Is in your permanent record. All your metadata. And you should have known all along, right? Every time you spend that debit card instead of cash, blam, permanent record. Was at Whataburger this time to that time. In fact, you might even try to create yourself an alibi that way if you're committing a crime. Right? What? I wasn't there. I was at the Whataburger, man. Driving through and getting a bacon cheeseburger. Anyway, point being, there's a line and they've crossed it. They have the ability to turn over everything they've got to the cops, to erase all the lines of jurisdiction, to de facto nationalize all the police in America. And integrate all the data that the locals got on you, that the states got on you, that the feds got on you, and put it all together. Permanent giant fishing expedition against everyone. And in a land where we already got 150 zillion laws. Right? There's a famous book, which I actually have and should have read and interviewed the authors about, but never got around to. Maybe I will one day. It's called Three Felonies a Day. And it's about how, man, if you got out of bed this morning, they can nail you to the wall for the fraud you just committed. They will find a way. In fact, come on. If you're more than 10 years old, you've probably heard someone say, they know a FBI guy who one time said to them that, you know, you just point to me, anyone on the street, and I can find a way to lock them in prison for 10 years. You haven't heard somebody say that? I've heard people say that so many times. Like, everybody knows that any FBI agent with a grudge against anyone, or who's just having fun, and just thinks it's hilarious to destroy somebody's life and family and whatever, can just do that. They can just pick somebody at random and find something to imprison them for. That's how many laws there are. You could be, just not be guilty of anything, and they can still convict your ass. And that's how compliant the court system is, of course, too. And then they'll charge you with 150 things and go, man, you don't want us to convict you on all this, do you? You better plead guilty to some of it. Trial by plea bargain, no jury for you. They just extort you into agreeing to a prison sentence by threatening you with a worse one. And anyway, so you can see, it doesn't take a genius, witness me describing it, it doesn't take a genius to imagine a real totalitarian nightmare of an America where the National Security Agency is turning over all of their haul to the domestic cops to do with what they want. Where the local, state, and federal computers are all combined, not just coming, but going, too. In fact, if you go back and listen to my interview with Tim Lynch from 2003, you'll hear me saying, isn't this the threat? That we're going to expand the national security intelligence apparatus and its capabilities so much, and then we're going to let them turn it inwards to our domestic policing? Now, this was so far out of Tim Lynch's imagination, he couldn't understand the question. I rephrased it three times before I finally gave up. He kept thinking I was complaining that, I think this was his complaint. He was saying, yeah, that's what I just said, that the locals are going to be turning over information that they have to the FBI or something. Well, the locals have actual information about some Al-Qaeda dudes running around. That is not really a problem. The problem would be the NSA turning over what they have on all of us that they've gained under their supposed authority to tap Al-Qaeda. Now you get it. And you know what? Three cheers for Edward Snowden. Nobody praises this guy enough. Look at the situation he was in. I don't know if he was a full-fledged Ron Paulian or not, but he had donated to Ron Paul. He's a libertarian-leaning young man. Probably a fiscal conservative type, you know? And patriotic. So patriotic, he went to work for the CIA to protect America, the country, from its enemies. And what he got wind of there, he just couldn't take it. And he decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm giving this hall to Greenwald, man. There's somebody I know I can count on to take this information, to be responsible with it, but to expose the illegalities and the immoralities going on here. It's got to be done. And then the funny story is, Greenwald wouldn't answer him back. So he went to Laura Poitras, and Poitras knew Barton Gellman from the Washington Post, and Barton Gellman was familiar enough with some of this stuff that he said, yeah, I think this guy's legit. They checked him out, you know? And that was how the whole thing started, and then they went back, and I guess Gellman and Poitras, or just Poitras, went back to Greenwald and said, hey, this guy's legit, and he wants to talk to you. Anyway, you can read all about that in the New York Times. I actually did a really good profile all about how Greenwald and Poitras got the story. But anyway, and if you're not familiar with Greenwald, to a lot of us, Greenwald has been a hero for a long time. I mean, he's a, I would say, a cookie-cutter progressive, except just obsessed with the Bill of Rights. And he's got an incredibly sharp lawyer's mind, and he's just a relentless writer. And ever since 2005, when he created the Unclaimed Territory blog to cover the original NSA scandal of the Bush administration, as broken by Risen and Lichtblau, as held by the New York Times for a year. Ever since then, man, he's been great. And I knew, back before Obama became president, I put it to him on this show that, hey, man, you're going to stay good when the Democrats are in power, right? And he said, yeah, of course. And he has. And he's, you know, created a lot of enemies on the left because they all wanted him to give Obama a free pass. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. Conversation at the Future Freedom Foundation conference in 2008, Joseph Raimondo from antiwar.com was saying, I kind of like Obama. He's giving a great speech about the war the other day. And Greenwald was saying, I don't know. I think we're just going to have to wait and see. He was the more skeptical. And I walked up into the middle of that conversation and said, you both have got to be kidding me. This guy's just Bill Clinton. And he's going to start killing people his first day in office. And anything good that he ever said was a lie. And anything bad that he ever said, you can take to the bank. And you're both nuts if you think otherwise for a minute. He's a Democrat. If he wasn't the devil, they wouldn't have given him the nomination. He wouldn't even have a chance at it. Give me a break. I'm a very cynical type. You know, it's pretty obvious to me. But I could tell then that Greenwald, when he said, hey, let's wait and see, he was trying to be as fair as possible, but he knew I was right. And of course, he has stayed good on all of his very same principles. You know, the Bill of Rights, peace, and the truth about the Bill of Rights and peace. That's his thing, just like me. Only he's a progressive and I'm a libertarian, but otherwise, same priorities. And so you could see, I could certainly see. I'm not, you know, I know some of you may have not really known about Glenn Greenwald before the Snowden thing. But I'm just saying, I could see what Greenwald represented to Snowden. They're like, man, who am I going to give this to? You give it to James Risen, the New York Times might make him sit on it for a year. Oh, man. That must have been infuriating. But anyway, so who are you going to give it to? Who you know that you can count on to go all the way to prison with it if it comes down to it? Glenn Greenwald, man. And so Ed Snowden made off with at least 58,000 documents. At least. According to the claims of the UK government, I guess. I don't know. Greenwald said 20,000 documents. I don't know if that's documents or pages or what you call it, right? However you catalog that. But anyway, he gave the entire haul to Greenwald, Poitras, and Gelman. And I urge you to go listen to Barton Gelman's interview with Terry Groves, where, and he's a very, you know, straight, objective reporter. He's not an activist like Greenwald, which I'm not saying that's a problem. I'm saying that's what I love about Greenwald. But Gelman is the kind of guy who says, look, I'm not going to defend Snowden from your accusations. I'm not going to take his side, okay? But I can report to you that what he told me was, I want you to publish this stuff very carefully. I want you to use your journalistic judgment to make sure that no innocent people are hurt, that no technological secrets fall into the hands of countries that are going to better enable them to oppress their own people, that no legitimate American national security concerns are jeopardized at all. He did not just upload it all to WikiLeaks, to Julian Assange, and say publish it all online. Assange actually complained about that. Said, give it all to me. I won't hold on to it. I'll publish it. But that's what he wanted. Because he's just trying to be responsible with it. All these accusations that he just couldn't wait to, you know, see America's enemies benefit, just nonsense. You know, I hate to even draw attention to this thing, but it's good for a laugh, I guess. That guy Jamie Kirchick from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and Commentary Magazine wrote a thing accusing Greenwald and Snowden of treason. And let me see if I can get the exact words out of my brain here. I don't have it in front of me. But when it comes to Snowden turning over America's secrets to Russia and China, he actually, one of them is, in all probability, and the other is something like must have, or seems like he coulda, right? At two places, he tries to assert that, in essence, everybody knows that Snowden just must have given America's secrets up to the Chinese and Russian governments, when in fact, there's actually no reason to believe that whatsoever. He said, hey, I only talk to journalists. The closest thing you could say talk to a foreign government would be a newspaper in Hong Kong. And that ain't the PLA, the South China Morning Post. And he didn't give them military secrets. He said America's spying on your universities. Okay? And then, according to Gelman in his Fresh Air interview, I think I got my footnote right on that. I'm almost positive. It could have been something Greenwald said. But I'm almost positive this was Barton Gelman in his interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air on NPR. You can find the archive on the internet. That Snowden doesn't even have the codes to his own secrets anymore. That, yeah, I'm almost certain this was Gelman talking. That if the Russians just took him to a dungeon and drugged him and tortured him, they could not get the secrets because Snowden no longer knows the codes to get to them. Snowden has hidden the password to the code somewhere. I don't know if Greenwald has it or who has it, or if nobody has it to his version of the documents anyway. He has already transferred the documents to the Washington Post and the Guardian and independent documentary filmmaker, and it's on them now. So, in fact, there is every reason to believe that he has not sold America out to the Chinese or the Russians. In fact, speaking of WikiLeaks, There's a woman named Sarah Harrison, who is a lawyer that works for WikiLeaks, who has been with Snowden virtually this entire time. And in fact, WikiLeaks put out a statement, I'd say 3 weeks ago now, maybe 4 weeks ago now, that said that she has been by his side the whole time. And they, as an organization, WikiLeaks, can affirm to you that he most certainly has not been in the custody of the Russian government or the Chinese government, and has not been debriefed by them, has not turned over anything to them. They can vouch for that as an affirmative fact. And then what do the smear artists have? Oh, boo-hoo, in all probability. In all probability, huh? Yeah. Time Magazine actually published an article that said, well, you know, what the Russians, in all probability, did was drugged him. And then took him away. They gave him Rohypnols. And then questioned him and got everything. And na-na-na-na. And he went on and on for 750 words. Or more. Really? Because what? Because that's my imagination. And somebody turned that into a Time Magazine editor, and a Time Magazine editor ran that story. It probably ran in the magazine. I don't know. I read it online. Probably ran in the magazine. Oh, Edward Snowden. Did you hear he was drugged and turned over everything to the Russians? Oh, no. Didn't you hear? That was simply the fantasy of some fiction writer in Time Magazine. There's not an iota of evidence for that anywhere. Here's what the evidence is. Ron Paulian, disgusted by violations of human rights, decided to do the right thing and steal the criminal secret truth and turn it over to a heroic, intrepid, civil rights crusading blogger slash journalist and a documentary filmmaker to make sure that the American people would know the truth so they could at least try to do something about it. That's awesome. And for anybody criticizing him for fleeing to Russia instead of drinking the hemlock, as his lawyer, who's now betrayed him, apparently Bruce Fine, put it the other day, you go drink hemlock, man. I think it's plenty heroic to liberate a bunch of documents and turn them over to Greenwald. He's got to turn himself over to solitary confinement in the cell next to Ramzi Youssef and Ted Kaczynski now? Or worse, he should be taken and tortured in Lithuania. I don't think so. I think, hey man, have a nice life in Russia. I like Russian chicks. I married one. I think he'll do just fine there. And, you know, the thing of it is, Bradley Manning was immediately put in the most horrible circumstances, was exposed by a rat who lied to him and told him he was an ordained minister and a journalist, and so your secret is double safe with me, while he was turning over everything to the government. And as soon as he was arrested, he was put in solitary in horrible circumstances in Kuwait. He was held for 3 years without trial. He was abused and humiliated and really tortured. I mean, they would poke him and wake him up every 5 minutes to make sure he hadn't killed himself in his sleep somehow. For months. That's torture. And so people, you know, decide, hey, let's all stick up for Bradley Manning, because first of all, what he exposed is heroically important. We had the right to know, and he did the right thing turning it over to us. And then double extra, look at this, what they're doing to him. Her. It ain't right. So, come on. Free Manning. But with Snowden, he sort of, kind of got away with it. Didn't plan the best escape route, but he's at least relatively free in the suburbs of Moscow somewhere, apparently, for now. And so he has not garnered as much sympathy. Well, he hadn't had to go through as much. But never mind sympathy. What about just plain appreciation for his heroism and what he risked and what he gave up and what he did so that the American people, so that the people of the world would have access to these documents. As divvied up by Gelman and Greenwald. But again, I think I pretty much agree with that decision. I don't know. Actually, you know what? I wouldn't really mind if they dumped it all. But I could see how, I mean, we all remember how they smeared Manning. Oh, blood on his hands, indiscriminate leak. Blood on his hands, indiscriminate leak. And those kind of slogans really hurt. But in this case, I mean, in this case, they just replaced that with, oh, boo-hoo, Russia, China, like this is 40 years ago or something. There's always a smear to be had, but they can't really accuse him of an indiscriminate leak of trying to aid America's enemies or anything like that. He was very careful about it. And it's not Greenwald, in case you think that Greenwald's strong opinions somehow disqualify his strong opinions or the facts that he reports or something like that. Well, go hear it from Barton Gelman, the straight reporter, objective newsman from the Washington Post, where he can report to you that Snowden was very specific about, now don't go jeopardizing America's actual national security. We're here to expose wrongdoing, not right-doing. Gotcha? Gotcha. Capiche? All right, then. So, I think that's important. And anyway, I don't take enough time out on the show to praise that guy and to thank him. And I ought to write an article. I was thinking about that the other day. I ought to write an article about thank you, Ed Snowden. Maybe somebody else has already done it. I don't know. But it seems to me like I appreciate it. And also, what was my real point? My real point was, hey, the best of the right just wants to conserve classical liberalism, right? And the best of the left, they just want classical liberalism for the littlest guy. And I know there's a lot of socialist misunderstanding of how things are on the left and whatever, but there's a lot of honest intent. And I think at the end of the day, the American people, if it's really put in front of us where we really have a chance, I think the American people would prefer to have a division of us versus them on a more, not to be too commie about it, but more of a class basis than a conservative liberal feeling of a base. Peace and liberty, that's what we need, and that's what we want, right? So it seems to me like we could put aside abortion and we could put aside, you know, try to ignore labor disputes and whatever the hell kind of left-right issues divide people for a time till we can get this whole Bill of Rights and world empire thing straightened out, you know? Is that too much to ask? I don't really think so. I mean, it kind of bums me out if Rand Paul is the best that the future can hope for when it comes to that realignment. But then again, I don't know, man. Yeah, then again, I don't know, man. But anyway, it's always, 99% of the time, the presidential candidates on the left, it's a conservative Democrat. And on the right, it's a liberal Republican, right? The moderate centrist. The one who can get the most swing votes wins. That kind of thing, you know? But it's always Barack Obama and John McCain types. But what if it was Ron Wyden versus Rand Paul? You know what I mean? You see the difference there? We're like, you can't really call Rand Paul a liberal Republican, but you can call him a libertarian Republican. So he's a centrist in that sense. He shares some very important priorities with the left, like fairness in sentencing and some other things. And, of course, Wyden is pretty good on some constitutional issues anyway. And so why should it have to be that the candidates, why should it have to be that the personifications of these parties all represent the worst of what liberals and conservatives believe in instead of the best? Yeah? Well, I think it's up to libertarians to lead the way, really, because we're the ones who are right about everything. Right? All right. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Realign yourselves. And I'll see you Sunday morning on KPFK.